You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a USDA food box program has provided farm produce to people in need of food in Wisconsin, but a letter from the president in some of those boxes is generating controversy and some legal questions for nonprofit groups. A WPR reporter gives us the details. First, the death of George Floyd and the shooting of Jacob Blake, among others, have put a spotlight on police departments' use of force. Wisconsin lawmakers have formed a task force to look into racial disparities and police issues. Here's Representative Sheila Stubbs on the objectives.
We cannot let our action devolve into political football. We cannot allow another unarmed black person to be shot and or killed.
In a new report, our next guest digs into the use of force by Wisconsin police, especially in the state's three biggest cities, Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay. The report also calls for better collection of data on police use of force. Patrick Hughes is a Badger Institute corrections consultant. He's the author of a new report, Police Use of Force, How Common Is It? A Call for Greater Transparency. He previously served as Assistant Deputy Secretary and Division Administrator in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Before we get into the findings, I want to turn to the second part of the title here. You make a big case for more collection of data and more transparency of that data when it comes to the police use of force. What do you want to see in Wisconsin?
What I'd like to see are statewide standards on both classifying uses of force by law enforcement and also standardized reporting out so that all departments are making regular annual reports on what their officers are doing on the streets.
And you found, as you started to try to collect this kind of data, there's a lot of apples and oranges types of issues, right? There's not currently consistent data collection from one jurisdiction to another.
No, there's almost no statewide standards. We tended to see, especially with the larger big city departments, that they tended to classify incidents similarly, but there were some, for instance, that weren't reported at all. Green Bay chose to use vehicle pursuits that ended in a pit maneuver, which is a maneuver to stop a car, and they reported that out. Milwaukee and Madison chose not to. So it made cross comparisons difficult.
So you looked at the three biggest cities in the state, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and Madison. Big picture, put it into context for us. How common is the use of force by police in general? And then we can break it down by the kind of force you looked at.
I think in general it's some good news here. It's just a little bit over 3% for Milwaukee and Madison, and then a little bit higher, right around 4% for Green Bay.
And let's talk about what that's a percent of. You considered as best you could the use of force in arrests and use of force in police calls in general, even if they didn't result in arrests. Tease that out for us a little.
We used arrests for all three cities because that was where we had the best data. And that's where we generated the 3% number and the 4% number. Madison, which had a very good report, actually, provided also information on calls for service, which really covers everything from, you know, a traffic accident up to, you know, a bank robbery. But we chose to use arrests because it's a common theme through all departments, and it's something that I think that the reader can understand as a common police occurrence, but also one that probably has a higher likelihood of involving a use for force.
And you also break it down, again, as best you can, by the kind of force deployed. Can you give us the range of types of force that might be included in this report?
Sure. We broke it down into the largest category was bodily force, which encompasses an officer striking a suspect or grabbing the person or wrestling the person to the ground. And that happened roughly 70% of the uses of force incidents consisted of bodily force. That's unarmed contact between an officer and a suspect. We also looked at the use of pepper spray, electronic control devices or tasers, and firearms, of course.
And what did you find when you looked at firearms specifically?
It was a relatively low number. So for the year 2019, there was 32 officer-involved shootings that resulted in 18 fatalities. City of Milwaukee, for example, had in 2018 five uses of firearms in which two individuals were killed, one was injured, and the officers missed, didn't hit anyone on the other two.
Talking to Patrick Hughes from the Badger Institute. He's the author of a new report on the police use of force in Wisconsin, focusing on the state's three biggest cities, Milwaukee, Madison, and Green Bay. Patrick, one thing you didn't try to accomplish in this report was to try to figure out whether individual uses of force could be seen as justified or not. It sounds like that would have been a much more complicated report. Could you talk about why you steered clear of that?
We steered clear of that because that would really kind of require us digging into each individual case and then, you know, really to get a good interview, interviewing the officers, interviewing the suspects, and trying to determine how they reach those decisions. We didn't have that data available, and we were trying to figure out, you know, if you're a lawmaker, if you're a citizen who wants to know what's going on inside your police department, how can you go about doing that? And, you know, with the data available, this is really the best that we could put together to give the average citizen kind of an idea of what's going on in their police departments.
An interesting part of the report was in Milwaukee, where you could see uses of force by individual officers and how many times an individual officer might be involved in the use of force. What did you find when it came to trends there?
We found over two-thirds of officers didn't use force at all over the course of a year. It was actually roughly around 14% of the officers that used use of force. And there were several officers that used force at a much higher level. One officer, for instance, was involved in 24 incidents. But this is where kind of the frustration arises with the lack of detail in some of this data is, you know, we don't know if those officers that tended to use force more were involved in, say, a SWAT team or an anti-gang task force that would involve more regular contact with violent individuals. So it's good to have more information, but I wouldn't, you know, jump to any conclusions on whether an officer using force more often is a result of misconduct.
Now, you touched on what we know about the use of force in departments across the state that may not have the kind of fine-grained detail you're looking for or comparable detail, but what kind of things did you find out when it came to the use of force in police departments in general, especially maybe in some of the smaller jurisdictions?
Well, I think the biggest problem there is we weren't able to find much. You know, I think part of what our study revealed was the larger city departments have, you know, both more resources and they're expected to produce more regular documents that show what they're doing. Some of the smaller departments, I believe that they have the records. I believe that they are tracking internally what their officers are doing, but they don't produce regular reports that make it easy for researchers or the public to know what's going on.
And that may not be because they don't want to do it. It may be they don't have the staffing to do such a thing.
They don't have the staffing, or they may not even, you know, if you look in parts of our reports, many police departments, especially smaller departments, make very few arrests in the course of a year. And, you know, the city councils and the fire and police commissions are, you know, are reflective of their communities, and they're keeping track of what their officers are doing. Regular reporting standards that are mandated by the state and require reporting would allow, for instance, when police reforms are initiated, either at a national or a state level, for us to track their effectiveness. And I think guidance to police departments and showing them what's expected for reporting requirements and how to do that would be welcome.
Can you talk about what you would hope for if we had that kind of more consistent data across the board and across the state, what policymakers might be able to do with that?
Well, I think the initial benefit to that is kind of setting a baseline so that when reforms are initiated down the line, they can track data over, say, 5 to 10 years and see if a new reform or a new training practice is resulting in fewer officer-involved shootings or fewer uses of force. It can also help identify departments that may not be supervising officers appropriately. If a department, say, in another city of a comparable size has twice as many uses of force as another department, that is kind of an indication that maybe there's something going on in that department that can be changed or can be monitored before something bad happens.
Now, these issues of police use of force, obviously big issues this year. The governor calling for some kind of changes. We'll be talking to a co-chair of a task force on related issues. Are you hearing interest from policymakers in doing the kind of things you're talking about, getting this consistent data collection across the state? Are you hearing it from the people who can actually make it happen?
Yes, I think both Senator Wongard and Governor Evers have proposed tracking officer-involved shootings and also incidents that result in great bodily harm. And I think that's a good start. But really, you're going to miss the vast majority of use of force incidents if you don't include bodily force, the use of tasers, the use of pepper spray. Those are where the majority of these use of force incidents are occurring. And if you don't include that in the legislation, it may not get reported.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Patrick Hughes with the Badger Institute. He's a corrections consultant there. He recently wrote the report titled Police Use of Force, How Common Is It? A Call for Greater Transparency. Coming up, a presidential letter in a USDA food relief box is generating controversy here in the state. We'll talk to a WPR reporter who's following the story. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's our weekly look at the latest news in national politics, including the latest coronavirus relief efforts in the U.S. Senate, to the long continuing saga as the House and Senate try to advance plans for more economic relief. First, one non-food item is making waves after appearing in food boxes in August as part of the USDA's Farmers to Families program. Along with vegetables, cheese, and chicken nuggets redistributed from farmers was a letter from President Trump. Rob Mentzer is a reporter for WPR based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, tell us first a little about these food boxes and this Farmers to Families food box program.
So this is a coronavirus response. This is part of a response to COVID-19. When the pandemic hit and schools closed down and restaurants closed down, one thing that happened is millions and millions of Americans lost their jobs. And another thing that happened was farmers and people who sell foods lost customers in the form of schools for school lunches and restaurants. And so this USDA program helps both, right? It works on both sides. The U.S. government buys food from American farmers, packages it into these boxes, and then distributes it through local food pantries and distributors all around the country. They've distributed 8.2 million boxes since May. And so it's a way to help the farmers and a way to help the families who may have fallen on hard times.
And it sounds like food banks and others who are participating in this program like it. It's a good way to get fresh produce to people, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I actually went and distributed boxes one time a couple weeks ago in Wausau, and there's just like a line of cars down the street. It's a very simple process, and it removes a stigma, which is sometimes a concern among food pantries that people might be reluctant to come forward. But like there's a need and there's a desire for these services for sure.
And now there's this letter appearing in at least some of the boxes. Tell us about this letter signed by the president.
Yeah, so this is the where the controversy comes in. On White House letterhead, this was not the case in May and June and July, but sometime in August, some number of these boxes began to include a letter from the president who says that he, sort of touts his administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and this program in particular. It is not, it doesn't mention the election. It is not the most sort of like overtly electioneering message that like you would hear on a TV commercial or whatever. But it did raise the objection from some Democrats that this is a form of sort of political tampering that's not appropriate for a USDA food program.
Now, you talked to Donna Ambrose, executive director of the Neighbors Place in Wausau, about what she thinks of having the letter in there. Let's take a listen to some of what she had to say.
We don't want people to think we're affiliated either way. Our job is just to get food to people. We're distributing these boxes, and that's what we're here to do. We're not here to make a statement.
What else did you hear from nonprofits about the situation they worry about with the letter?
Right. I mean, this is exactly the problem is nonprofits. These are, you know, most food pantries, these are 501c3s. And in a lot of cases, that is the case with the Neighbor's Place, for instance. And by law, they cannot participate in partisan politics. They can lose their 501c3 status if they do. They can talk about the issues. They can talk about what they're involved with and the need. But what they can't do is, you know, endorse a candidate for public office. So this created a real, you know, concern among nonprofits in different parts of Wisconsin. I talked to some people who were reluctant to go on the record about this, in part just because it's a headache for them. They don't want to be perceived as being against this letter. They don't want to be perceived as being for this letter. You know, a nonprofit has to be concerned about how they might be perceived by a donor potentially. And, you know, and of course this legal issue. So this is like where a big part of what the conflict is the question of, you know, is this appropriate to include? But also then, like, you know, are these nonprofits authorized to take it out if they want to? Do they need to, like, notify people or provide a disclaimer that says they're not taking a partisan position or so on? It's been a headache for a lot of them.
Talking to Rob Mentzer, WPR reporter based in Wausau, about a food program, a USDA food program supplying produce from farmers around the country to people in need during the COVID-19 economic downturn, and some controversy about a letter signed by the president in those food boxes. Rob, was there an answer to that question of whether, if I'm the nonprofit organization, I'm worried that this is going to make it look like my organization might be endorsing a candidate, about whether they can take that out?
So, not a definitive answer, but what the instruction of those that I spoke to, they had been instructed by the distributors that they cannot take it out. There's some debate about whether if they're adding other things or making other sort of changes to what is provided, whether they could. But like it's not known. The USDA did not comment for my story, has not commented as far as I have seen to any media outlet that's inquired about this. And so, you know, it's like there's like a lot of unknowns around this. One of them, by the way, is exactly where they're going. Like, from my understanding, some distributors in Wisconsin didn't have them, some and some I know did. But we don't, it's like hard to track where they are or whether that's why. Is that targeted or is that just how the USDA is rolling out this program?
You mentioned that there was some political concern from Democrats about this. Is this just public expressions of concern, or are Democrats taking any action in response to this?
Sure. A group of 49 House Democrats sent a letter to the USDA that made the claim that that the letter is inappropriate and a violation of federal law. That would be a violation of the Hatch Act, lately famous Hatch Act, which prohibits members of the executive branch from engaging in political activity. So that's a letter. That's not quite the same as an action. There do not appear to be, you know, congressional hearings scheduled on this or other forms of action, but it does show that there is an accreting political desire among some Democrats to try to get these things stopped.
And this food program, this food redistribution food box program, does it have an end date right now?
So its first end date was August 31st. Then it was, you know, and when I spoke with folks, they were not sure whether it would be extended into September. It has been. The new end date is September 18th, I believe, and there's some thought that it may be extended again. It's quite up in the air. I don't know how long it will go.
And I want to shift gears in our last couple of minutes, Rob. We heard a piece you did yesterday about how COVID-19 is changing the way people run for office in a very practical way. What kind of things were you hearing from candidates? You heard from Democrats and Republicans about how COVID-19 is shaking up the way they expected to be campaigning for office this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's actually some creativity in the political world, Rob. You wouldn't expect it, but it's but it's the case. You know, first of all, a candidate now has to wonder every time they knock on a door whether they might be turning off the voter inside that house rather than connecting with them if they are perceived to be doing something that's like not respectful or not safe. So a lot of candidates are going door to door, and I assume we're going to see that more in the coming next couple of months. But it really has changed the way that a lot of candidates operate. I went to a kind of interesting fundraiser that was a walking tour about pollinators in the city of Appleton, hosted by a Democratic Assembly candidate. It was kind of interesting. It was not the usual political fundraiser, but it was something that could be done outside. They required masks and people kept their distance. And so it was like a way of bringing people together and maybe getting some more name recognition for that candidate, Lee Snodgrass of Appleton, without like putting people at risk.
And you've seen at least more Republicans doing in-person events, at least so far. Is that about right?
Yeah, it was very clear over the summer that that Wisconsin Republicans at all levels were more likely to be doing in-person events, in-person campaigning. Republicans had their state convention in Wisconsin in an indoor space in person, with sort of mask optional. So, you know, the distinction is extremely stark in that respect. I have a feeling that it will become less stark as the election gets closer. I suspect that there will be more Democratic in-person candidate, events. We're already seeing a bit of that.
Rob, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Hey, thank you.
Rob Metzer is a reporter for WPR based in Wausau. He joined us mainly to talk about a USDA food program and concerns about some politics alongside the produce. Plus, we touched on his recent reporting on how COVID-19 has changed campaigning here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, it's the week in Washington. We'll get the details on the Postmaster General's alleged campaign finance violations and check in with the latest on the presidential race, including visits to Wisconsin by both vice presidential candidates for the major parties. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, gravitational waves help tell us how the universe began, but are we sure we know how it's all going to end? An astrophysicist tells us why we should keep calm about the cosmos. That's coming up today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. First is the week in Washington, where we catch up on some of the week's top stories in national politics. Among the stories this week, on Labor Day, Wisconsin received visits from both Vice President Mike Pence and Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris. With 54 days left, we'll check in on the state of the presidential election. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you participated in any campaign stops from either of the campaigns? Does it matter for you if we get in-person visits from the candidates here in Wisconsin? Do you want to see your candidate, whoever that might be, come to the state? And if you don't have a candidate yet, does it matter to you if we get that visit? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with some new news out today. Bob Woodward's forthcoming book includes a couple conversations with President Trump, where he admits to knowingly playing down the significance of the coronavirus pandemic publicly in February and March. Some recordings out of Woodward's interviews with the president. What has been the reaction to that so far?
Well, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. If you are talking to Republican senators on the Hill, they're saying, you know, we're not shocked by this at all. There's nothing wrong with Trump doing this. He's a positive person. He didn't want to make people panic. I think the reaction from, you know, a lot of journalists, a lot of pundits, you know, has been a little bit more surprised, because, you know, Trump was telling everyone at the time publicly that the coronavirus isn't that serious. He was comparing it to the seasonal flu. And he was really trying to make people believe that it was no big deal. I remember him saying that it would be gone by April. It would be gone when the warmer weather kicked in. And here you have him saying that he knows this is very deadly and this is very serious. And, you know, it's not just a matter of the president lying or the president saying one thing in private and in public. You know, there's a large, you know, number of people in the public who really do listen to him. And if he had said this is serious, you need to wear a mask, you need to stay home or something like that, you know, how many lives would have been saved, and would people be behaving differently, and would the pandemic be more under control if Trump had conveyed that he too thinks it's serious?
We'll be talking more about that on the Ideas Network in the days to come. But expectation, I think, at this point is it won't be long before we see Biden campaign ads or anti-Trump independent groups having audio back to back of the president talking to Woodward and the president talking in public. Do you see this likely to be a campaign theme for the Biden campaign?
Oh, absolutely. You already saw the Lincoln Project, which are a group of sort of disaffected Republicans who have been making quite a few videos and ads, you know, sort of hitting Trump. They already put up something on Twitter comparing what the president said with his White House press secretary recently saying, you know, no, Trump has never downplayed this. He's never downplayed it at all. And then you also had Biden himself today talk about it during his stop in Michigan, saying that he willingly lied and purposely played down the coronavirus. So absolutely, I think Democrats and Trump's opponents will be doing this quite a bit more.
We'll keep watching for developments on that. Also this week, the Justice Department announced yesterday that its lawyers would represent the president in a defamation case brought against him by columnist E. Jean Carroll. Can you give us the background leading up to this decision?
So E. Jean Carroll says that Trump raped her decades ago in a department store. And in 2019, in interviews, Trump denied raping her, and she sued him for defamation. The case, you know, I can't stress how unusual it is what's going on here. The Justice Department has decided to intervene and try to move the case to federal court out of state court. And they are essentially saying that because Trump made these comments that he's being sued over when he was president, it's not a matter of him being a personal citizen. It's a U.S. government issue. And so if there are any damages now in this case, if E. Jean Carroll wins, for example, taxpayers are going to be on the hook. And so this is happening now, right as the case seemed that it was going to be moving forward, perhaps to get DNA or evidence gathering. And what this move does is it slows the process down again. And so it seems to protect Trump. Underlying all of this is the fact that Attorney General William Barr has shown himself to be the protector that Trump has always wanted. Trump was furious when Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russia investigation, saying, "You were supposed to protect me." He always, you know, said he thought JFK was so lucky because his brother, you know, was the attorney general and could protect him from anything. He thought Eric Holder did that for Obama. And so Trump has finally found his guy in Bill Barr, who has shown that he's willing to contort the Justice Department to protect the president.
We're looking at the top stories in national politics. Amanda Turkle is with us from HuffPost. She's Washington Bureau Chief there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We're going to turn to the presidential race and candidate visits to Wisconsin now. Let us know if you have attended an event with one of the candidates, if you would, if given the opportunity, if it's important to you that candidates for president, vice president, or key players in their campaign show up here in the state. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. feels like the election campaign's already gone on basically forever. But Labor Day is kind of noted as the kickoff day for the home stretch. And we got visits from both vice presidential candidates. I want to give a listen, first of all, to Vice President Mike Pence and his visit to Wisconsin on Labor Day.
And when this president stands up every day and fights for American workers and jobs, jobs, we stand with President Donald Trump.
And Senator Harris, the Democratic candidate, also focused on jobs and the economy. Here's a little bit of what she had to say in the state.
To small businesses throughout our country, including here in Milwaukee, that we see you, we understand the significance of what you are in terms of the health and well-being of communities, and we see the benefit to the entire country to invest in our small businesses.
How big a deal, Amanda, are those in-person campaign stops, especially in a weird year like 2020?
honestly, it's yet to be seen. It seems like, it seemed like they were hurting Trump for a while because he was having these rallies, and the news out of them was the fact that people were getting coronavirus from them. And there were all these people not wearing masks, not socially distancing, and that a lot of people weren't showing up to these rallies that Trump promised would be, you know, gigantic. And so Biden really benefited from sitting back and letting Trump sort of dominate the news cycle and that and get the bad press. But a lot of Democrats started to get worried that that wasn't going to be enough going into the home stretch, that Biden really did need to get out there. And so you are seeing Biden and Kamala Harris start to campaign, but they still look very, very different from what Pence and Trump are doing. Pence and Trump tend to, again, have bigger events. Maybe people are wearing masks, maybe not. There isn't a lot of social distancing, whereas what Biden and Harris are trying to be sort of more careful and stay on message about what they believe should be done with the coronavirus. They're smaller, they're more distanced, they're not the sort of bigger gatherings that you're seeing on the Republican side. And they're hoping that, you know, they can get more press by having folks out there. And that, you know, they're just finally simply getting a chance to interact with voters more in the limited way that they can.
It is interesting, though, the energy of talking in front of a, group of applauding people is different than the energy of applauding or, you know, talking in front of a camera or a very small group in a more controlled environment. I mean, there's no way to know really what impact it's going to have. Is that something that you're seeing, though, in what ends up in the news from both campaigns?
Yeah. And, you know, the convention seemed like they were going to be a real test of that. You know, I think of the State of the Union response every year, which honestly, a lot of times is just excruciating to watch. They're very awkward, whether it's a Democratic politician or a Republican politician. It's just very weird. But it seems like the folks did a little better this time at the conventions. And I would say especially Biden, talking in sort of an intimate, emotional way, directly to the camera, especially because he addressed people who had lost loved ones due to the coronavirus, actually worked very, very well for him. And it was a speech I think he might not have given as well if he were speaking in front of a larger crowd. Biden chose Kamala Harris. He was considering some other people who weren't quite as experienced at sort of big campaign events and national campaigning. But obviously, Kamala Harris ran her own presidential campaign. So going out and doing these stops and doing these speeches is something she's good at. And so, she is being deployed, especially to reach out to communities of color to make sure that they come out to vote for the Democratic ticket.
I always like to ask our national reporters how important Wisconsin is. We're seeing visits by both campaigns. Another poll out today showing Biden with a 4-ish% lead over the president. That's pretty consistent. I assume Democrats are not assuming they can take Wisconsin to the bank based on what happened last time around. How important do you see Wisconsin in this campaign?
Incredibly important, as always. As someone who's been to Wisconsin, many, many cycles, it was gearing up to be important already because of the economic issues, Trump's trade policies and things like that. But then with what you have, with what happened in Kenosha, it has this added element, which is why you saw Harris go and, sort of discuss the racial justice. She protests. She talked by phone with Jacob Blake, who was, you know, shot in the back by an officer on August 23rd. And then you have on the Republican side, Republicans also feel like Wisconsin is central to their message because they are trying to draw attention to, you know, the violence, the looting, things like that, that they say Democrats will allow to, you know, take over the suburbs and threaten the livelihoods, basically, of white suburbanites. And they believe that there will be enough people who are sort of nervous about what's going on, that they'll vote for the Republican ticket, and that their message that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are socialists who will let mobs run wild will take hold. So Wisconsin, you know, has all these facets that are central to both campaigns' messages.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle about the latest news from the nation's capital. She's Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you watching for in the last couple months of the presidential race? Do Wisconsin campaign stops influence your vote? Do you listen to the candidates' speeches? Call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in on that. Also, we'll get to another possibility of action on another COVID-19 economic relief package. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's the Week in Washington, our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. We continue our talk with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost. Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Joe on the line in Star Lake. Joe, hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Quick thought. My wife brought this up. Of course, the Woodward book has come out and the recordings and so forth. And given the timing and everything that people now are beginning to understand, I'm wondering whether we might see civil suits from families that have suffered from this virus coming forward against the president personally.
Well, that's an interesting thought. I don't know about the legality there, Amanda, but Could we see people taking action on this, or is it going to be a significant campaign issue here in Wisconsin?
About a lawsuit, honestly, I don't know whether we'll see that or what the legality would be, like you said. You know, in terms of it affecting the campaign, you know, I expect, you know, just this past week alone has had so many huge stories between this, the stories about Trump saying that people who serve in the military and are captured or who lose their lives are losers and suckers and not wanting, you know, veterans with disabilities to be in military parades because nobody wants to see that. You know, these are big stories coming out. A lot of people are shrugging their shoulders and saying, this is nothing new. We know this about Trump. But, you know, they're being backed up by Fox News, you know, Trump's favorite outlet. He's on audio with these latest coronavirus remarks. And so I think we are going to be seeing more and more stories like this come out, these sort of big stories. And, you know, I right now the public is very polarized. People made up their minds pretty early, but there is still that small segment that both sides are fighting for. And so, you know, we'll see whether these affect, you know, that segment and who they vote for.
Thanks a lot for that call, Joe, at 800-642-1234. Want to talk to this kind of evergreen topic over the last few months, Amanda. I think we've talked to you about it in the past. Is there going to be another COVID-19 economic relief package coming through Congress? Some action in the Senate, but it doesn't seem like it's necessarily going to go far. What are we seeing there?
Right. I don't think far. And Democrats have tried a few times. And McConnell, what McConnell is now proposing is a very small, slimmed down package, about $500 billion, which, you know, may seem like a lot, but Democrats have tried for $3 trillion. And even McConnell in July released a bill that was $1 trillion, but they just haven't been able to go anywhere. Democrats, you know, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, said that there's no way they're going to accept this $500 billion bill. It's not big enough. And it just has, you know, provisions that Democrats oppose, such as a liability shield for businesses to protect them from certain lawsuits tied because of the coronavirus. You know, so it's not even clear, too, whether this bill can get enough Republicans. Because, you know, there's some Republicans say that they are now concerned about the deficit. There's a provision in there about tax credits for homeschooling. So honestly, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but McConnell is hoping that there are some moderate and conservative Democrats in tough re-elections who put pressure on Pelosi and maybe, you know, try to work out some compromise or press her into accepting what McConnell is offering. And remember, McConnell himself is in a tough re-election race, so he needs to also perhaps show that he's doing something on this.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, Washington bureau chief there, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Another one now, allegations that the current Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, broke campaign finance laws. What do we know about the allegations?
So basically, you know, DeJoy did not get his job because he knows a lot about the Postal Service or anything like that. He got his job because he is, you know, he was a major Republican donor. And so the latest allegations are that, you know, his company in North Carolina, basically over the years, he told his employees, you know, you should donate to these Republican candidates. And then he gave those people bigger bonuses. And if that's what happened, you know, you donate $1,000 and then you get a $1,000 bonus from DeJoy, just coincidentally, and it's a bigger bonus than anyone else got. And it happens to exactly match the amount of money you gave, that's illegal. Those are known as straw donations. You cannot sort of skirt around campaign finance rules by paying someone else to give a donation. And so if that's what he did, that is illegal. He was asked about this recently before the Washington Post story about this came out by Congressman Jim Cooper.
Yeah, I want to give a list of that. We actually have that, Amanda, that exchange. Here's Representative Jim Cooper. You queued it up for us, and Postmaster General DeJoy.
Did you pay back several of your top executives for contributing to Trump's campaign by bonusing or rewarding them?
That's an outrageous claim, sir, and I resent it.
I'm just asking a question.
The answer is no.
So you did not bonus or reward any of your executives?
No.
Anyone that you solicited for a contribution to the Trump campaign?
No, sir.
So now we have the Washington Post saying that staff at his company said he did exactly those things. And some in Congress, some Democrats have said that means he may have given false testimony to Congress as well.
Yeah, and House Democrats say they're now investigating this. And, you know, they say he could face criminal exposure, not only for the donations, but then for lying to the committee under oath. And they're encouraging the Postal Service Board of Governors to immediately suspend him, which they're not going to do because it's run by Republicans. But yes, this is another problem for DeJoy, who has had a rocky tenure at the Postal Service, to say the least.
Well, the news fire hose is on full blast this week and today. Amanda, what are you watching for next in our last minute?
You know, I am watching to see how Trump gets himself out of this coronavirus, these coronavirus comments, and, you know, tries to spin them. He's already saying that he didn't lie. He's just an upbeat person, but we'll see the fallout from these.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Been talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington bureau chief at HuffPost. She joined us for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can follow more of the latest on these stories and more at WPR.org. State coverage there. And you can find stories from reporters at NPR as well on the latest in national news. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the conventions are over, but have they had an impact on the race for president? Polling expert Harry Enten is back with us on the show for a look at the latest in the presidential race around the country, and will key in on battleground states like, yes, us here in Wisconsin. The genetic editing technology called CRISPR is opening the door to lots of potential therapeutic treatments and raising some ethical questions along the way. The creator of a new documentary and a Wisconsin bioethics expert joined the show to share the latest on the cutting edge of genetic modification technology and many of the concerns and issues that it raises. Businesses around the country, many of them are not filing required accident and injury reports to the Federal Occupational Health and Safety Administration. That's according to a new investigative report. We'll talk to the reporters on that story. Plus, let's look ahead to Friday, Food Friday. We'll get to the some great advice on starting your first kitchen. If you've got some advice or some questions for our guest, get started now. Send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. All that and more coming up this week here on Central Time. This is a great time of year because every year around this time, the National Toy Hall of Fame comes out with its latest list of nominees from the world of games and toys. We often talk to their curator there. It's always a lot of fun, and people have a lot of great toy memories to share. Well, they have their new list of nominees out. I got an email this morning. I'm definitely on their list. Here are some of the latest nominees. We'll find out later this year which ones made the cut. There's Baby Nancy, a groundbreaking African-American doll that came out in the late 1960s. I looked into this one a little bit, and it kind of helped create or let people know there was a market for dolls that looked different than many of the white ones on the market. Also on the list, Bingo. You know, it's a game. It's a toy, I guess. Briar Horses. This is not part of my reality. The game Jenga. That's a pretty familiar one that I'm terrible at. Light Bright. Speaking of terrible at, this is a great pastime back in the 70s and beyond for people with attention to detail and creative graphic design skills. Not me. Masters of the Universe toys, He-Man and She-Ra from the TV cartoons. Other nominees, My Little Pony, the board game Risk, Sidewalk Chalk, Sorry, the game, Tamagotchi, that little pet blippy beepy thing. That was not the right age for that. And Yahtzee. We'll find out who wins later this year. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.